Pleasure for me to be here. Thank you, Jim, for this very nice introduction. I need my clicker first. And it's a pleasure for me to be here. Person who introduced, really, I mean, who gives you kind of some just initial thoughts on actually what the brilliant thing that the rest of this panel, is gonna talk to you about. And let me first say that basically my talk is going to revolve around the idea that we're broke, right? I mean, it's as simple as this. And the steps that we take in the future is going to actually make a difference on whether we actually deal with the fact that we have a little cash flow problem or whether actually we end up like Greece or I want to say worse, but I just can't really think about anything worse. So we have a lot of debt, but usually people don't quite get what debt is, right? The D word is not a very persuasive thing. We've seen a lot of charts actually kind of showing the unsustainability of our path, and, you know, but I think it is still worth trying to educate people and remind them what it means. This chart here is actually trying to remind people what the debt, the government debt is made of. And there are actually two major pieces. And so the total debt that we have is this green part, right? And this comprises all the government accounts, you know, like basically Social Security, Medicare, which is the yellow part, and also what we call the debt held by the public. So the green part is the yellow part and your dark blue part, right? And very often we focus on the public debt, this blue part. And the reason why we focus on this is because our assumption is like the yellow part is pretty much what the government owes us, or actually has collected to pay us off. It's actually an underrepresentation of what our what the federal commitment is to this nation. But usually, until recently, people were rarely talking about this part, right? And we've been talking a lot about the debt held by the public. And why is that? Because imagine what happens in your everyday life if you max out all of your credit cards, right? And you max them out, and yet you still want to spend more. What happens? Well, you get another credit card, and you roll over your balance, right? And you do this until your bank wise up and sees you for the big risk that you are and says, yeah, I'm really sorry. If you want to get this new credit card, you know, instead of actually a 12% interest rate, you're going to have to pay a 30% interest rate. And that's the only way you're going to get this card. And what's happening right now is like actually, and this is the reason why we care about this part of the debt, is like there's this thinking that at some point our lenders, the people to whom we owe that big chunk of money, are going to wise up and say, you know what, if you really want to borrow more money, and it seems that we will want to borrow more money because our deficit, we're planning on spending more money than we actually collect from revenue. That's what deficit is. We're planning on having deficits, you know, in our future and big ones. We're expecting to actually want to increase our debt and borrow more money. Our lenders might at some point say, you know what, you know, this rolling over the debt is just not going to work unless, you know, we charge you much, much bigger interest rate. And the problem with this is we are on a path where not only under the current assumption, when your debt, you know, keeps on going and you end up, the cost of your debt, the interest that you're paying on your debt, even if you're not assuming that lenders are going to say suddenly, we're going to charge you massive amount of interest rate, you know, our interest rate are going to go up the roof. Even in that case, what we end up facing is a situation, which is what you see here, a situation where the cost of our debt becomes bigger than all the other account that we have. This chart right here, I mean, draws a pretty dramatic picture of our country's fiscal outlook. Starting in 2012, the cost of the debt as a percentage of GDP will explode to a mere 1.8% of GDP to more than 30% in 2082. 30% in 2082. To give you an idea, it means like when I get to retire, if I am allowed to retire when I'm 65 in 2035, that gives you an idea of how old I am, the cost of the debt will have more than tripled. So from 1.8% today to 7.5% of our GDP will be consumed just for the cost of our debt, just to pay interest. I mean, but my daughter, Juliette, who's 7 today, when she gets to retire in 2070, assuming that she's allowed to retire at 65, which obviously is completely an insane idea considering what's happening, the cost of the debt will have reached 23.8% of GDP. So just the cost of our debt is going to explode. And that's going to be a lot of our GDP money, a lot of our money is going to go just to pay these interests. We're in big trouble. We need to change the course of things. There is no way around it. So we hear a lot about fiscal responsibility, you know, on the Republican side and on the Democrat side. I mean, the president has told us, you know, he was going to actually act in a way that while we're making investment today, we're also going to cut spending in the future. It's what Donald Meron calls the eat dessert now and spinach later, which I actually love this analogy. Oh, you can expand on it, of course. But as you, if you recall, like the main cost saving plan, if you exclude the healthcare, has been to actually freeze non-defense, non-discretionary spending, which is like a ridiculously small part of the budget. To freeze that part, that was like the big fiscal responsibility act in this budget. But this doesn't even start to cover it. Look at this chart. This is a chart that actually shows, with no doubt, even when we actually assume that the projections that are made right now are accurate and that our economy is going to keep growing, this chart shows you where our real problem is. And that freezing non-discretionary spending, especially just the non-defense part of it, is not going to cover it. Look at what you see. It's like basically our big problem is entitlement spending. This is what is going to explode in the future. And this is less than the cost of our debt, right? Because if you see the blue line, for instance, this is Medicare, the cost of Medicare. The cost of our debt is our biggest problem, but it's driven by this, by the fact that our entitlement spending is totally out of control. And we can zero discretionary spending altogether. We can decide that there will be no more discretionary spending. We would still be having a gigantic problem in our hands. And that's what Maya is going to talk about. Right, Maya? And we know this. Economists have been talking about it. The economic reality of the fact that mandatory spending is our real problem, that we are on an unsustainable path, is something that's been repeated. What I would like you to take to your members before I make my last point is that it is also politically unsustainable. There is a moment where people who are under 50, people who are 20 today, 30, 40, 50 are going to say, no way. No way we're going to elect anyone who doesn't actually watch for our interests. And basically, for lawmakers who are still pretty young today and hope to have a political future, I would really seriously advise that they get behind that group of people, because there is a moment where they're going to say no more. We're not paying more and more and more and more money to people who are already retired and have been retired for. And you can say, well, it's the right thing to do because we have commitments. It doesn't change the political reality. There is a moment, and I think this is what's fueling the Tea Party movement, is that there's a moment where younger people are going to say, we don't really care about these commitments. Either you start representing us or we're going to kick you out of office. And I would suggest that, you know, smart members get, you know, above of the curve on this one rather than wait until the crisis hit, because it'll be too late. But my final point is that the crisis is going to hit, probably, unless we do something, because it seems that no matter how extreme these charts are, no matter how unsustainable economists tell us the situation is, there is no true will in government still to this day to deal with spending. It is amazing to me. It is totally amazing to me. Whether, I mean, there are a few Republicans who have concrete ideas for cutting spending, but even the best-minded Republicans, the best thing that they can think about, like Senator Gregg and Conrad, is to actually have a deficit commission, a commission to actually slice deficits, which is very different. I mean, the deficit is an expression of a disease, which is not, the deficit is only the symptom. The disease is spending. And while I'm, you know, I would be in favor of, you know, a commission to slash spending when everything is on the table and it's an independent commission, I don't want to see anyone from Congress on that commission. I think that right now the commission proposal are just not going to cut it. It's not going to happen. More importantly, it's not going to work because you don't have any true will to cut spending. And one of the reasons we don't is that the budget that we see, the number that we used, are based over and over and over again on a lie. The number of budget gimmicks, big or small, that are used on a daily basis, on the Hill, in think tanks, informed or not informed. I'm not saying that, you know, people are using them just to trick people. It's just quite unbelievable. There's a number game that is played and that has been played for years now that actually has been hiding the true dramatic situation that we face. And numbers matter. So, for instance, I would argue that in order, before we can actually even make the case for cutting spending, it is time that we tackle and we try to put an end to all the budget gimmicks. So, for instance, every president does it. When you have a budget that comes out, they pick their economic assumptions. They're sometimes rosy, and most of the time they're rosier. They're making them say what they want it to look like, right? So, like, for instance, this president sees us growing by 6% in a year, in 2012. As much as I would love it to be the case, I don't think it's really realistic. I would like to see an end, for instance, to all the tricks that allow Congress to go over the budget caps that they themselves put in the budget to try to tie their hands. The use of emergency or the abuse of emergency spending, for instance, has been something that's been prevalent, especially in the previous administration. I mean, when you think that the entire war was funding through emergency spending, that's like a big budget gimmick. This president is also going to do the same. There's not for the war, but he's going to use and abuse emergency spending the same way. All the budget tricks that consist in keeping spending off the record. I mean, it's gigantic. Social Security, Medicare trust, related trust, Freddie and Fannie expenses. All this is off the record. How can we have a true picture of our outlook, financial outlook, if all this spending is actually not, you know, scored properly? I could go on and on. I mean, there's many timing gimmicks, accounting gimmicks. Like, obviously, a big one is the fact that the federal government counts its money, I mean, has a used cash flow accounting, which is kind of like something that the private sector would never do, is, I think, a real big problem. And I would like to actually, I'm hoping that, you know, you will take this idea to your members that now is the time to end budget gimmicks and to actually move forward with true budget and accounting reform so we can actually really see where we stand and create a true will for cutting spending. Until we do that, I don't think there's any way to move forward. Thank you. So I have like positive news later if you want to hear them. Like my kids are doing well.
Thank you very much. That is kind of a gloomy prognosis, and I suspect that our next presenter, Ms. Maya McGinnis, the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, isn't going to have a whole lot more encouraging news for us. But Maya, in addition to being the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation, is also the director of the Fiscal Policy Program there. And she oversees the foundation's efforts to bring accountability to the budget process and address the challenges presented by those unfunded entitlements that Dr. DeRuggi was just speaking about. Ms. McGinnis testifies very regularly. Some of you may already be familiar with her. She testifies regularly before Congress, and she is a prolific writer, having been published in the Atlantic Monthly, the Washington Post, Financial Times, LA Times. And before joining New America, she served as the Social Security advisor to the McCain 2000 campaign. She's worked for the Brookings Institute. She's been on Wall Street. And she has a master's in public policy from the Kennedy School. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Ms. Maya McGinnis. Please join me in welcoming her.
Okay, thank you so much. So my guess is that you all have sort of different levels of budget knowledge. So I'm going to try to hit it at the right level, but if I am saying something that you want to jump in on, disagree on, ask for clarification, or it's you want it more complicated, tell me either way. There's so many things going on in the budget right now, and I think I would start with Veronique's point that the debt is really one of the biggest sort of starting points. The debt is a really big problem from where we are, and I think you need not even get past the front page of the paper right now to see the kinds of warnings that we're having. So you have China warning us. You have China pulling back. I'm not sure yet why, but from its purchase of treasuries is sort of the news today. You have Moody's warning us that we stand to lose our AAA credit rating if we don't change the path that our budget is on. Yesterday we hosted a really interesting forum where one of the presidents of the Fed banks gave a speech on fiscal policy. I think that this is really big news because monetary policy and fiscal policy have a line that's always been drawn between them. It's clearly been blurred by recent actions of the Fed. But to have a president, a voting member of the FOMC, come and give a whole speech on the need to get on a sustainable budget path is just a huge wake-up call if there ever were one. So we're in bad shape. I'm trying to figure out how to give my talks without swearing because I keep feeling like for emphasis that there need to be a lot of bad words. But we're in really bad shape, and I'm not exaggerating. How did we get here? Clearly, the long-term problems, which I'm going to focus a little bit today on entitlements, have always been a problem. And a couple years ago, that's what I spent most of my time worrying about, reforming our entitlements, because we knew that we were on an unsustainable path driven by aging and healthcare problems. But we also have to add to that mix the fact that we were running budget deficits during times of economic prosperity. Generally, you can pick a different fiscal goal that you think is the right one, but generally you would say you want to keep your budget balanced over a business cycle so that you're able to run deficits when the economy turns down and you need to stimulate your economy, and you run surpluses when the economy is strong. That just has not been the history of the U.S., where basically, since we ran up a big debt after wars, which made sense, we never got back into the habit of running surpluses, certainly for a prolonged period of time. And one of the unfortunate lessons, I think, when we did run surpluses recently was that kind of lets the spending spree and the tax cut spree loose in Congress. That meant that all notions of fiscal discipline kind of left the Capitol. So I think one of the interesting challenges, I think a lot about budget process, we're working on a commission right now of outside folks to work on budget process reforms, but how do you create fiscal discipline in times of doing well, not just when there's an emergency. It's sort of like we're always regulating for the crisis we just had, but there, you lose the discipline during the times when things are good. So that's one of the things we're trying to figure out the answer to. Clearly running deficits when we had a strong economy made no sense. We should have been running surpluses. We should have been dealing with entitlement reform. We did not. Luckily, our debt going into the economic crisis that we just had was at historically lower average levels. So you add to the fact that we are already running deficits, we then get hit by a massive economic downturn. And people are always going to look back and disagree about how strong the risks were. I was one of the people who, you know, I have no idea how strong the risks were, but I was pretty concerned that we were headed for very, very dangerous economic territory. And even though I would get press calls all the time saying, aren't you worried about these huge budget deficits that were running last year? No, I wasn't. I really thought it was the time to stimulate the economy, and I thought that was the time when you have deficits and that we should be borrowing. And I don't think the stimulus package was perfect. Today is the anniversary, actually, of the stimulus, so I spent my morning doing talks on how many jobs it's created, and the bottom line is no one has any clue, and so sort of trying to debunk all the different claims about it's created so many jobs or not so many jobs, we really don't know what would have happened otherwise. But I did think stimulus was in order. But there's no question, one, that it wasn't perfect, but two, that that level of borrowing has ratcheted up our debt levels. So what we had going into the economic crisis was a whole lot of fiscal flexibility to respond. And what we will have coming out of it is far less fiscal flexibility. We'll have much higher levels of debt. That's why you need to start focusing on how to get that debt back down. Of course, just at the time that we're able to pivot and stop thinking so much about economic recovery and start thinking about what to do about these budget deficits, we're going to be hit by the massive wave of entitlement spending that's going to be brought on from the retiring of the baby boomers and the fact that healthcare costs, from everything that it looks like now, are still not going to be brought under control. I mean, any of you who work on healthcare, I have spent my whole budget career trying not to work on healthcare, and there was just no you couldn't avoid it this past 2 years. You had to learn about healthcare, and I think we all acknowledge that it's probably one of the biggest driving problem in the long-term budget. I still wanted someone else to fix it so I could fix Social Security, the nice, easy one. But I got familiar enough with healthcare reform to know we don't know exactly how to fix the problem. This is not something that we're going to have one comprehensive bill that gets on top of controlling costs. This is going to be the multiple bites at the apple going back and always trying to slow the growth of healthcare. And from the looks of where things are, where sort of every different version of the healthcare bills that came out ratcheted down the amount of long-term savings, we can see what a heavy push that's going to be. So I don't think you can rightly point that healthcare costs are probably the single biggest problem, not probably, are the single biggest problem in the long-term budget, but they're just not going to be the total solution because we're not going to be able to get at it and fix enough in healthcare that we don't have to do other things. So we're going to be hit by the aging problems, which hit us first. We're going to be hit by the healthcare problems. We're going to be hit by the basic tenet that we don't want to pay for what we spend. So we have deficits that are structurally huge, even once the economy is well on its well in the recovery, and that's not as it should be. So I think one of the questions that you regularly get hit is, you know, why should we care? And I work in a centrist think tank, but it's really interesting because a lot of the programs there disagree. And most of the programs, frankly, can't stand me because I'm the person who they have a great healthcare plan or education plan, and I come along to their office and say, like, are you going to pay for this? And of course they never are. Just like members of Congress, it's more fun to think of the great idea than pay for it. So there are disagreements even in my own think tank about the extent that we need to be worrying about deficits. I don't think there's ever been a time where we've had so many sort of terrifying warnings that we need to worry about deficits. And the fact that nobody knows what an economic tipping point would be for this country. We don't know at what point we would have borrowed too much. But whether you hit some kind of abrupt fiscal crisis or a gradual ongoing slow erosion of the economy, you don't want to find out. You don't want to reach that tipping point, which means we need to make those changes sooner rather than later. So from a budgetary perspective, of course, we saw on the chart that the more you borrow, the more your interest payments go up. And we are headed to a point where we are going to have a huge interest squeeze. One of the things, maybe Donald will talk about this, but when CBO does its longer-term estimates, it's not very it doesn't do a lot on what the likely effect on interest rates would be of all this borrowing. So if you were looking at the estimates, it is probably likely that interest rates will be, there's a good chance there'll be very strong upward pressure on interest rates. That in itself can cause us to suddenly be in a vicious interest cycle where we are borrowing more just to pay for our interest payments. You know, I'm sure you all get the same kind of kooky calls I do of, if you just did this, you could fix the budget. And it's nice that people call in with their ideas or write in crayon, as they do to me regularly. But, you know, a lot of the waste, fraud, and abuse ideas aren't going to work. Getting on top of interest payments really is the single most wasteful part of the budget when you're not borrowing for any purposeful reasons, which we're generally not. There, of course, is the economic threats of borrowing too much. And that's something that I think we're starting to see now, is that you're starting to see spreads showing that there is, through the markets, the effect of the over-leverage of our country and other countries are going to affect the cost of private capital. As we are sitting here right now thinking about what you do for high unemployment and the jobs creation, the desire to create more jobs, cost of capital going up is absolutely a move in the wrong direction. So you have the private sector economic ramifications of too much borrowing. For those of us who've been warning about interest rates because of deficits for years, it's always looked a little bit like Chicken Little because there was so much global savings available, interest rates were able to stay very low. But the point is you now have countries around the globe fighting for that capital, and you have new concerns arising about our country and other countries. You don't know when the cost of capital goes up. You do know that it takes a huge negative effect on your economy. Then the third effect is always sort of the intergenerational one, which is it really is unfair to say we are going to borrow because we don't want to pay for what we're spending today. It's not that we're borrowing because we're investing so much in things that are going to grow the economy. It's not like we're borrowing as a family as when we're borrowing to go to college. You know, the U.S. is borrowing for consumption. It's not an investment budget that we're running at the federal government level. So I had this thing where I was talking to what I thought was a TV interview, and it turns out I was being poll tested, which you never really want to find out after the fact. And somebody sent me a photo with lines plummeting down when I was talking, and I was talking about actuarial balance. And they said, you know, that's just not a nice way to talk. It alienates your audience. People don't really like you. When you talk about these things, what you need to do is talk about your children. And this was a while ago, and I said, but I don't even have kids. And they're like, it doesn't really matter. You need to hold pictures of fake kids and talk about it so that you'll be likable. So I always sort of resist the whole intergenerational thing because I was so annoyed to get poll tested and have failed and have to make up children to be likable. But there is an intergenerational element. I will not show you any photos. But there is the whole point of, you know, you do want to leave an economy that's stronger for the next generation. We do know that there will be new challenges and new opportunities. We have a budget that, because of entitlements, which are so locked into the budget, has very little flexibility. We can't change the course that we are on, and we risk leaving an economy where the standard of living is growing much, much more slowly than it should be because of the excessive borrowing that we're engaging in now. The politics of all of this, of course, is toxic. Entitlement reform, pretty much any time you start talking about how we're actually going to fix this situation, raising taxes and cutting spending, the two only ways that we're going to get there, things get ugly. And they get particularly ugly when you turn to entitlements. There's no question that the part of the budget that has the most pressure in the medium and long term now are entitlement spending. And so when I talk about it, if you look at the chart of where the problem comes from, I don't really think there's much debate about it. The problem is a spending problem. That's what's pushing the budget up in the long term. At the same time, I don't know how many of you in your offices have ever gone through this exercise of actually trying to reach some fiscal goal. We recently ran a commission. I didn't even bring any reports today, but if you're interested, it's at budgetreform.org. But we came out with a report called Red Ink Rising. And what this is it's a report that says we really need to stabilize the debt so it's not growing faster than the economy at a reasonable level over a reasonable amount of time. We came out recommending 60% of GDP in 2018, and we sort of have six steps of how to get there. In order to make a recommendation like this, my board of directors, who are all the folks who run OMB and CBO and the Fed and the budget committees, we went through this exercise of seeing what it would actually take. And I will tell you that trying to stabilize the debt at 60% of GDP in the medium term is really, really challenging. And so the conclusion I come up with, and this is not a position of our organization, we sort of support any moves in the right direction, but I think if you look at where the problem comes from, there's no question it's on the spending side of the budget. If you look at where the solution comes from, I can't think of a possible way to fix this without having every part of the budget. That's entitlements, that's discretionary, that's taxes, that's tax expenditures, the spending that goes through the budget and sort of dressed up like tax cuts, all the credits and deductions and exemptions that politicians love to give because they sound like they're a tax cut, but they're really more like a spending program. I don't think you can get there without touching every single one of these pieces. So in that vein, sort of the politics of this is just this Gordian knot I don't know how to break. I do not know how to get folks to start realistically saying it's not just going to be earmarks, it's not just going to be waste, fraud, and abuse, it's not even just going to be, you know, small spending freezes. It is going to be the things that are at the heart of this budget, entitlements and everything else. So I think we're going to be talking about all the things that pollsters aren't very fond of, but raising the retirement age, slowing the growth of healthcare, so much more than we are talking about in the healthcare reform bills, reducing promised benefits and Social Security, not extending all of the tax cuts, and that doesn't even begin to get you there, but even for the middle class, I think the promise of not raising taxes on people making less than $250,000 is going to be very, very difficult to stay true to. The numbers just don't get you there. So anyhow, rather than being kind of the bearer of all the bad policy news, one of the things that I encourage offices to do is go through the exercise. Pick a fiscal goal. And I think having a fiscal goal is critical. It used to be kind of the goal of let's balance the budget by X. I don't see how we're going to balance a budget anytime in the near future. But if you want to pick a goal of cutting the deficit in half, if you want to pick a goal of stabilizing the debt, pick a goal. It's so useful to have one because then we can sort of start comparing plans. But go through the exercise privately on a scrap of paper that can be burned afterwards, but with the member of Congress, and see how you actually get there. Because once we've done that, I'm hopeful that that allows us to have sort of a more productive conversation about all of this. So I think I'll stop there because I'm really looking forward to doing Q&A, and I've covered a vast amount of things there. Hopefully we will have a big discussion after Donald talks. Thank you.
Thank you, Maya. Well, we heard about the dessert before spinach, but I think you're getting plenty of spinach today. And since Dr. Marin is the one who originated the idea of the dessert before spinach, we'll turn now to him. Professor Marin is a visiting professor at Georgetown Public Policy Institute here in Washington and teaches microeconomics and public finance. Some of you may recognize him because he was once one of you. In addition to having been a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, he was the acting director of CBO and executive director of the Joint Economic Committee. Before his government service, Dr. Marin had a varied career. He was a professor, a consultant, an entrepreneur, and in the mid-1990s, he taught economics and finance at the University of Chicago. Dr. Marin received his PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a bachelor's degree in mathematics at Harvard. And do you have happier news for us, or are you going to continue to tell us what dire straits we're in? We'll turn it over to you. Let's welcome Dr. Marin.
Hey, thanks. So it's fun to be here. As you can tell from the intro, I am a guy who can't keep a job. And so I have done various and sundry things, including I have fond memories of recess. So congratulations that it's recess. Enjoy the free food. And I indeed did the similar thing back when I worked on the Hill, which I enjoyed tremendously. So I want to start actually by reinforcing one thing that Maya said, which is about the importance and utility of a fiscal goal. It really is incredibly useful just to lay out a vision of where you want to go so that you can figure out how to get there and so that you can work through in the privacy of your own office of what it would take to get there. I've come up with my own what I think is a reasonable goal for America, which is a slightly modified version of what Maya's group came up with in Red Ink Rising, because it fits better on a bumper sticker. I would recommend as a goal to think about would be getting the debt to GDP ratio, which I realize is an incredibly geeky inside baseball goal, for which I apologize. But like balancing the budget is no longer a tenable goal. Unfortunately, it would be nice, but it may be tenable, but it's not something that seems easy or accomplishable. But so getting the debt to 60% of GDP by 2020, which I now bumper sticker as 60 in 20. Right, so that's my recommendation as a goal, and as close to a bumper sticker as you're going to get.
A bumper sticker that only a math major would
have. I'm sorry, but, you know, but fits on a bumper sticker. So the organizers asked me to talk about three things, which I'm happy to touch on. The first is on the urgency of dealing with our crisis, looming fiscal crisis now, rather than putting it off another 5, 10, or 15 years. Second is to talk a little bit about the financial crisis and how that has influenced where we stand in terms of our fiscal situation. And then the third is to talk a little bit about the political barriers to fixing this problem. And you've already had snippets of this from Veronique and Maya before me, so some of this will be repetitive. So first, let me just start with urgency. This is a big looming problem, and all of us budget types are running around saying that the sky will be falling one day. We can't tell you when, which is, you know, an unfortunate truth. But, you know, nonetheless, we are on a trajectory that just doesn't work. And for me, the best evidence that we're on a trajectory that doesn't work is that if you look at the president's budget and you look at all the things that he specifically proposed, we end up on a trajectory where the U.S. debt, right, the fiscal debt that Veronique showed you graphs of, grows faster than the economy, which is our ability to pay it. The debt grows faster than the economy in every year in the future for all the rest of recorded, you know, future recorded time. We're on a trajectory in which even when the economy recovers and even when the president's proposals take effect, we're in a situation where the debt is growing faster than our ability to pay it, right? And that's just a trajectory that doesn't work, right? That blows up. You cannot incur debts that are bigger, that grow faster than your ability to pay. Eventually, the world causes you great pain and suffering. And what is the pain and suffering? And for me, I bin it into three categories, which is first, that it's a threat to our prosperity. A threat. And second is that it's a threat to basically good governing, right? Good behavior by our government. And the third is that it weakens our position in the world. And on prosperity, the story there is basically, as Maya suggested, is that if we run up large debts, it means that the federal government is competing with the private sector and having access to capital, right, to finance things. And that eventually that will show up in significantly higher interest rates. And in essence, you hear this described as crowding out, that as our borrowing goes up, the amount of credit that's available to the private sector goes down, we get less investment, and we're going to have a less prosperous future. The second is, and this is something that the Federal Reserve member that Maya mentioned discussed yesterday, is that, you know, at some point there also becomes concern about inflation, that historically many countries around the world have dealt with out-of-control budgets by trying to inflate away, right, by going to the Federal Reserve and saying, you know, we really don't want to tax people to deal with our spending problem. We want to tax people to pay off these debts. Could you please just print some money and send it over? And, you know, there are plenty of situations in which central banks have caved. And that is not a story that ends well, right, because you get inflationary pressures, and that, too, hurts the private sector, right? Interest rates go up, prices go up, people have a hard time. It is not a good place to end up. And, frankly, for a variety of reasons, it probably doesn't even work that well. Right, in our country, you know, all of, you know, you and the people like you over time have figured this out and have gone out there and indexed most of federal spending to inflation already. Right, so if we have a sudden burst of inflation, you know, Social Security payments will rise more rapidly. The amount doctors are paid will rise more rapidly, and as a result, it even doesn't save very much of the problem. So, thing one is out of control debts eventually are a threat to our prosperity. Second, and this is one I think that doesn't get quite as much attention, is it's also a threat to kind of good governing by you folks and your bosses. Which is that, you know, for the reasons Veronique described, you know, as debts rise and the interest burden on the federal budget rises, right? That's going to at some point crowd out other stuff. And I was impressed when I worked for the president, the previous president, as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. One of my jobs was to go to meetings of the Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development, the OECD. I would be the U.S. representative on economic issues with other people who are basically, you know, from developed economies, primarily from Western Europe. And, you know, many of those countries have adopted much more, if you will, generous or ambitious kind of social welfare programs than we have here in the United States, have adopted a much larger role for government. But it turns out, and I think this is not a coincidence, they were also much, I mean, you know, I was constantly being criticized for the large deficits in the United States from the point of view of people who in the United States system would be viewed as being quite far on the political left. And the reason why is that they viewed in their countries that if you ran large deficits, there were threats to the social programs that they valued. And they had very much a view that austerity and getting budgets under control was important so that you could have government serve the needs of its people rather than just be servicing debt or having those programs cut in the future. And I think that's a significant risk for us. And then a second is, you know, if you think about it, in principle, any well-managed organization ought to have basically a rainy day plan and a rainy day fund. Right, you guys ought to have rainy day funds in your personal finances, right? right? If something terrible happens, Congress suddenly has layoffs, you know, you want to have some, you know, which is, I know, highly unlikely, but nonetheless, you know, you want to have money that you can call upon in a state of emergency to carry you through until you can get back on your feet. Okay, how does that work for the United States as a whole? Our rainy day fund is the ability to go out and issue debt and have people buy it. And you may have noticed it's been raining, and you may have noticed that we've used this to great effect, right? We went out into a world where all of a sudden the world fell off a cliff. We needed to raise a couple of $1 trillion, right? One of those words that now flows off the tongue melodiously, right? Trillions, completely accustomed to it, whereas a few years ago, you know, billions was still the numerator of interest. And, you know, the world welcomed it, right? We could go out and raise trillions of dollars, and, you know, you can have lots of debates about whether the money was well used or poorly used. But nonetheless, our fiscal situation did not constrain our ability to try to respond to the crisis that we faced. Okay, that's not something that scales, right? That worked when the debt-to-GDP ratio was 40%, right? It might work when it's 50 or 60%. It's not something that's going to work at 70, 80, or 90, right? At some point, you get the world capital market saying, you've got to be kidding, right? We're not going to lend you a few more trillion dollars. You've shown no right ability to pay it down, no commitment to paying it down. And, you know, tough luck, right? Good luck with your problems, right? So if we want to be able to govern and respond to crises, we need to have that operating room. And the best way for us to have a rainy day fund is to have a relatively low debt-to-GDP ratio so we can borrow when crises come along. And then third place in the world, right, Maya mentioned this. You know, we're now in a situation where, you know, if hypothetically the President of the United States wants to meet hypothetically with the Dalai Lama, there are hypothetically people in certain countries who will say, hey, you know, we buy an awful lot of your debt and, you know, we're really kind of miffed about this. And there's just, you know, a situation where, I mean, in this case, the President's going ahead with it, but where our fiscal posture puts us in a situation where other nations of the world view that as a bargaining chip that they can use against us to try to leverage what we do, right? And that's, again, not something that strengthens us. We want to be in the world in a position of power, not one where we have to worry about whether our creditors will show up to buy our debt the next time we have to roll it over in a year or two. Okay, so that's kind of saying there's a big problem, right? Then what's the urgency of dealing with it, right? The urgency is on several fold, right? The first is at some point these problems are going to come home to roost more vigorously. It's hard to know when exactly, right? We've gone through a weird economic period. The world capital markets have not lost their faith in the United States just yet, right? But that point will come, right? Greece 2 years ago could go borrow at will, right? Greece cannot today, right? There's a reason for that. And you never know exactly where it's going to come, but you know that it's out there and you never want to hit that point. The second reason we need to treat it with urgency is that many of the changes that we would like to undertake are going to take time to go into effect, right? So, for example, if you're concerned about healthcare spending and Medicare, one of the proposals you might consider is raising the age at which people are eligible for Medicare, right? Currently 65. Imagine you wanted to raise it to be 67, so it was the same as Social Security, okay? That is not something that you're just going to unload on the American people, right, in the dark of night one day in response to a crisis, right? Because you've got all the people who are 66, 65, 64, 63, 62 who have planned their lives around the notion that they will qualify for Medicare at 65. And so a plausible strategy that is nice to people who are planning for their lives is to say, you know what, we're going to raise the age that you're eligible for the program, but we're going to begin to phase it in, okay? May very well be the right thing to do from a policy point of view, but it's not something that you can save for the day of the crisis. It's something you want to do now so that it's in place over time and you get the benefits later on. And then relatedly, just more generally, you know, at some point world capital markets are going to start bidding up U.S. interest rates because of our fiscal problems. And that's going to put a damper on the economy, as I said before. And to the extent that we can plausibly and credibly show a plan to get our fiscal situation under control, we'll be able to convince capital markets to back down for that. Maya has something she calls the Announcement Effect Club, of which I am a proud member and early member, which basically says that, look, you know, we're worried about the state of the economy today. One of the things that affects the state of the economy today are interest rates and how much it costs to borrow. And to the extent that we can credibly demonstrate to the world that we're going to have a plausible fiscal trajectory in the future, right, those interest rates will come down. Financial markets are forward-looking, and we'll actually get some economic benefit today. So for all of those reasons, it makes sense to act soon. Now, putting this in the larger context of the financial crisis, right? So we went through a financial crisis. It was very expensive. You know, I don't have a specific number for you, but, you know, think about it. Orders of magnitude, the financial crisis added $2 or $3 trillion to the debt, right? And I'm so cavalier that I'm like, $2 or $3 trillion, what's the difference? A trillion among friends. And that's, you know, the result of many things. People often talk about that as though that is the result of the policy choices that were specifically made by the previous administration and the current administration along with Congress. And it is certainly true that both administrations made some decisions that helped build up that number, but that's not most of it, right? Most of it is the fact that we have a system in which tax revenues fell off a cliff when the economy fell into a deep recession, and a whole variety of spending programs automatically increased, right? Medicare, unemployment, those kinds of things. The automatic stabilizers are very large. And so a large portion of what you've seen of the buildup of the debt is something we, in essence, pre-programmed into the system through the structure of the tax code and the structure of various benefit programs. And then there were various policy steps we took, obviously, to expand those further. And so if you think about it, you know, $2 trillion, that's a lot given the magnitude of the debts we have today. But still, the moral to take away is that the debts that are we're lined up to accrue in the future from entitlement spending and the imbalance between spending and revenues still dwarf that by many multiples. You know, I mean, depending on how far you look at, you know, they're 5 times as large, 10 times as large. So financial crisis, bad, lots of debt. But really, when you look ahead, right, just oodles more, mountains of more debt coming as we look into the future. And then finally, just a few words on political barriers. You know, and you guys, I mean, you guys from your experiences already know this, right? So my whole dessert spinach thing has been taken. But, you know, there is not yet, although it seems to be building, but there is not yet a lot of political reward to saying, hey, America, you need to eat some spinach, right? You have to get by with less government spending, possibly higher taxes than you've had traditionally. And we've lived in a situation which, for better or for worse, the United States could run large deficits even in a time when the economy was growing, and there didn't seem to be a large penalty in terms of interest rates or other things that that forced the government to change its behavior. Right? If you remember back to what happened in the Clinton years, right? If any of you have read about those times, James Carville's famous quote that after he died, he wanted to be reincarnated as the bond market. And the reason why was that everyone was afraid that if the Clinton administration did something fiscally irresponsible, the bond market would punish it by raising interest rates, and that would be bad for the economy when he was trying as president to get the economy to grow. Right? We're not in that world yet. Right? We need to be afraid of the bond market again or of something, but we aren't there yet. And as a result, it's difficult to find the political will to change things. And then my other sense, you know, having sat in your seats for a few years, I kind of did this thing where I worked in Congress for a while, then I went up to the White House, then Congress, then the White House. I cannot tell you how many conversations I had during that period, which were basically in the, you know, we are going to deal with these problems in the next odd numbered year. I mean, I had these just everywhere along the way. Just, okay, just, you know, after the next election, right, people will be settled down, they'll know who's in charge, and we'll have, you know, 6, 8, 10 months where we can get together and find the political will to solve these problems in a bipartisan way, all, you know, singing hosannas. And having been through many of those odd numbers of years, I can tell you it doesn't seem actually to happen. And, you know, the specter of the next election arises very quickly, right, particularly for those of you who work here on the House side. And that there's always this feeling, I feel, that one party or the other is constantly feeling that it will be in better position 2 years from now to strike the long-run fiscal balance that it wants to strike, achieving its goals, and that therefore there's a large incentive to put off those decisions until then. And as a result, you end up with, in essence, gridlock on dealing with the long-run problems, which is then coupled with efforts that make it worse. Right? One of my concerns currently about the Congress is that there's a lot of desire that recognizes, you know what, the door is going to be shut one day on this problem. Right? But for the moment, it isn't shut. And so while there's a big hole, we really ought to dig faster, right, rather than stopping digging. And so when you look around at various bills that have been proposed, and I can tell you stories about the climate change bills, the health care bill, the student loan bill, you know, all of those have attributes that I, as a budget geek, look at as ways that we might improve our budget situation. Right? Student loans, there's some stupid ways in which we do the subsidies in student loans at the moment. Right? We could find a way to save money on that and help the budget. But if you look at the bills that are out there, the bills take most of the money they would save and redeploy it into expanded education spending. Now, I'm not going to rail against expanded education spending because I think education is important for our nation, but the mindset is one where we're finding money here and then we're using it to increase spending over here, and that the taxpayer, the person who worries about the debt, isn't getting very much of it, if any. Similar thing on climate change, right? The climate change bills would create $1 trillion worth of tradable permits, $1 trillion over the next year. And if you look at it, you know, $9 billion of that ends up flowing through to reduce deficits, right? And the other, you know, basically $1 trillion gets spent in one way or another. Healthcare bills similarly, right? There are a bunch of things that are on my to-do list of things you would do to rein in health spending, you know, fix Medicare Advantage, various other things. All very good things that could help us with our long-run fiscal situation, but instead in the healthcare bills are things that are being used to expand the government's role in that area. And again, you can defend each of the individual decisions individually as possibly being good policy. My point is just from a large view, what we have is a situation which basically there's a PAYGO mentality. And PAYGO sounds good as a budget principle, but it does have this effect that this long list of things that budgeteers might think are useful ways to rein in the deficit are plucked off and instead used to expand other programs. And when the time comes to actually try to address these problems, we're going to have kind of fewer levers to work with. I don't think I achieved saying anything happy. Sorry. But...
This is always my favorite part of the program when we get to hear from you and what's on your mind. We have a brilliant panel, and unfortunately we don't have an audience mic, so we'll ask you to speak very loudly, but we'd like to have a Q&A session, and so if you have questions for any of the panelists, please just put a hand up and we'll get going with questions and answers. Okay, go right ahead, Veronique.
Yeah, actually, I have one for the two of you. I mean, the healthcare spending explosion. I mean, there's a supply. I mean, there's a cost element of reining in spending. I mean, and it doesn't seem that it's ever actually really been done effectively in any system to actually really trying to control cost, right? Unless you have, do you have an example of actually a system that truly, effectively, credibly could actually reduce cost without basically, you know, slashing the demand? Is there, I mean, like, would you work on the demand or on the supply side of that equation?
Well, so card-carrying economist, you will not be discovered to hear me answer that, of course, I will work on both the demand and the supply. There are a bunch of these facts, right? So there are these facts that if you look across countries, right, we seem to spend a disproportionately large share of our economy on healthcare. And, you know, that there may be lessons to learn from that about levers one could pull. And then the number of levers that are promoted as possible attributes that you might pull on, you know, range dramatically from changing the incentives that consumers face when they go into purchase, right, to changing the incentives that doctors face when they decide what care to provide you, right? The classic talking point there is that we have a system that rewards the volume of care that is provided rather than the value and quality of that care, and that whether you could move to a system that does more to reward providing value. You know, as an example, it's not popular, but an example of that is if you go back into the 1990s in the United States, where the growth of healthcare costs did slow substantially for a period during which there was basically a rise of HMOs and a rise of capitated payments in which HMO were compensated basically a fixed amount for taking on a particular person as being one of their beneficiaries, and they had strong incentives to rein in cost. Now, they weren't real popular, right? I remember myself yelling at my doctor once when he threw me out of his office when I came in with two ailments and he was only willing to see me for one of them. And so there are downsides to that, but I think there is some evidence that those kinds of things work, right? The Rand Health Experiment suggests that some degree of pricing things so that consumers have some skin in the game can affect their behavior. But then in the long run, I agree very much with what Maya said, that, you know, Social Security is basically a challenge of we know what the dials are and we have to agree how to spin the dials. And I don't want to underplay how hard that is, but it is a dial-setting problem. Right, health is really more of a research and development problem. We don't really know what to do. We have a whole bunch of hypotheses. We ought to try them. We ought to implement them in large scale. But we're going to have to constantly adjust as we learn how people respond. And it's going to be, as Maya said, it's going to be an ongoing challenge, not a one-time thing.
And I think there's no question that the problem is so big, and any economist would look at it and say you have to work on both sides. I think the healthcare bills probably didn't work on both sides as much as they could have. If I were picking three things that I would make sure would be in any healthcare bill, I would go back to the original the change in tax treatment. So the employer exclusion for the tax for the tax exclusion for employer provided healthcare is something that pretty much across the board everybody thinks would put a huge clamp down on the growth of demand for health insurance and the push up in healthcare costs. If you want to tax Cadillac insurance plans instead, okay, but I would go for just the actual doing what we're trying to do, which is reduce the incentive or the bias for providing more health insurance as opposed to other things. It's certainly not a favorable thing for workers. We sort of give them more of something that they may not need as much of. Most people would rather have straight out wages. So So often when you have the tax code incentivizing one thing over another, it leads to inefficient outcomes, and this is one example of it. I certainly think changing the structure of the healthcare industry so that you pay for outcomes rather than for procedures is a really important thing to do. And then finally, I don't think there's enough of this in these bills, but thinking about how you change the demand side, what it is that people go into the office, the doctor's office, and ask for. If you've gone to an HMO, you've had the example of not loving the quality of service, but you've also had that bizarre thing of going into your doctor's office and not knowing how much something costs. And there's no, on the individual level, denying that that has an effect on what we demand. So pretty simply, I think looking at basic incentives and triggers of premiums and co-payments and HSAs where they're appropriate, not for preventative care but for different kinds of health care, should all be part of a package. Big picture, though, the whole narrative on health care reform that we received was you can't possibly pass any of the hard stuff without dramatically expanding insurance as part of it. I think that there is some sense in that, but I think we put the cart way before the horse here. I think we focused very much on expanding health care and creating a new entitlement, an open-ended entitlement, and put the controlling the cost part as kind of the afterthought. And they have to be switched if you're looking at this from a fiscal perspective. There is no denying that you need to focus on the pieces that many members like the least, but the ones that would control health care costs. See how much savings we get. We have a healthcare system that we can't pay for it as it is. So as Donald was talking about, taking any money you save and plowing it back into the system doesn't make sense when we still have a huge fiscal gap that we have to close. So I'd think about saving first and expanding after.
Wouldn't you add introduce competition, state competition between states for insurance? I mean, allow insurance to compete? Yeah, okay.
We have a question right over here.
I have a political question. With the elections that occurred in Virginia and New Jersey and more recently in Massachusetts, does that provide any political cover, even in an election year or, as you say, the odd year, for folks up here to begin to address some of these issues that you have talked about?
Oh, so, again, card-carrying economist. I've never fully understood politics. My sense on that, for example, is that it is, you know, the House at the moment has the option of passing the Senate health bill and being done with it, quote-unquote. But you will have noticed that they haven't. And I think there are a couple reasons for that. One is there are various things that they don't like. But I think another is that it has... The election results have strengthened the hands of some of the folks in the majority who have concerns about the budget implications of the health care bill, and that it's basically a higher hurdle for them before they'd be willing to go along.
Were you asking about health care or in general?
In general.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the problems that I see with it is that when you talk about the deficit and the debt and the unsustainable budget trajectory that we're on, you get a lot of nods across the country. People completely understand that. It's not quite a Ross Perot moment yet, but people are really unhappy about both the level of spending and borrowing in this country. But when you start talking about what it's going to take to fix it, you lose your audience. So I have given plenty of talks where I get a lot of nods at the problem, and then I say, and so we're going to raise your taxes and cut your spending, raise the retirement age to fix the problem, and there's not really a friendly face left by the time you've gone through that. So I think that's where the challenge is that you have people who are all acknowledging that this has to be fixed, but when you get into the specifics of fixing it, that's where things fall apart, and I think the political parties rightly come to the conclusion that they can score more points by beating up the other side if they're trying to fix it than working together to do so. So in thinking about that, I've come up with three tiny, tiny baby steps that the members that I work with or the staff that I work with that I've been starting to recommend, and I would welcome all other ideas on what they are. But obviously running a bipartisan group, this is something we think about a lot, how to get people to work together. You're not going to solve this with one party alone. So the three things that I think, it's going back to what we talked about a little bit, but having this fiscal goal is critical. Because once it's out there, You can't have the argument of, okay, I would slow the growth of Social Security benefits, raise the retirement age, and lift the payroll tax cap on one side, and the other person saying, oh, my God, you're being terrible to my grandmother, and I would do nothing. The program's fine. You would have the fiscal goal of you have to fix Social Security. So you could either do it in that way, or you could do all price indexing, or you could do all tax increases, but you could at least compare the different options. So the fiscal goal means that real plans, credible plans, get the trade-offs evaluated. The second point is, to Donald's really important point, that once you have a fiscal goal, instead of just having a pay-go mentality, which is we're going to do new things, but we're going to pay for them, you have to go farther. You've elevated actually dealing with the deficit and debt ahead of new priorities. So we can talk about more tax cuts. We can talk about new spending after we've gotten in front of the fiscal situation. So I think that fiscal goal is critical. The second thing that I found that's really good is two of my members of my board, who are former members, Charlie Stenholm and Jim Colby. If any of you followed this years ago, they worked on a Social Security reform plan together. And one thing they did with a bunch of other members was they made a pledge that any member of Congress who suggested something to help fix Social Security, they would not attack. And if anybody from their party attacked that member, they would actually fly to their district to defend them. So it was sort of a, we might not like your idea, but you can't throw stones until you have your own idea. And so I think that kind of pledge towards achieving a fiscal goal is a useful one. You might not like the Paul Ryan roadmap plan, but until you have your plan, you can't criticize it. And get more plans out there. And then the third is just what I mentioned in the privacy of the office, trying to work through this problem with policy specifics, because I still think that there is a misguided notion that we can do this kind of incrementally, grow our way out of the problem, do it while taking certain parts of the budget off the table, and I just don't think any of those are true. So we're not there yet. I don't think this is going to be, you know, the month or the year where we come out with a plan. I wish it were. I really think this announcement effect is huge. If we commit to a plan now, we can phase it in more gradually. But I don't see the politics quite there yet. But those are some of the kind of baby steps I'm hoping we could see.
Yes, sir.
The other thing is actually I totally agree with having a goal, a fiscal goal. I mean, I think like the real problem is to actually have this fiscal goal and to stick to it. I mean, we've gone through the exercise how many times where, you know, a president will say we're going to cut the deficit in half. I mean, that's one form of fiscal goal, in half by 2009. And then the next, you know, in the next budget cycle, he announced with a straight face another fiscal goal. And we are not holding, you know, commitments to – we're not holding the president and Congress to the commitments that they've made. And I think that's – I mean, that's something that we need to absolutely kind of work on, is how do we make these promises, or even how do we actually build fiscal goals that are actually – that they have to stick to. I mean, and I think, like, while we are seeing a real anger in the American people now, they are worried. They actually really – I mean, they care about spending. 80% of Americans were polled. They say that they worry about the size of government and government spending. We need to actually start directing this anger no matter who is in Congress, because one of the things that we know and that public choice economists have studied about is the incredible poor incentive that exists, whether your heart is in the right place when you go into government. I mean, the incentives are such that you really want to eat your dessert right now and, you know, and claim that you'll eat the spinach later. I mean, and that's the nature of the beast. And we cannot say, I mean, I can't say that because we're going to have the Republicans, you know, things are going to change. So, I mean, I think, you know, budget processes and things like this and building credible commitments that actually, I think, really, I mean, it starts with the accounting way. I mean, accounting process are just, you know, extremely important just because of the nature of the beast. I think
start by telling the truth.
Yeah, well, and giving incentives, no matter who's in power, to be held to the promises that they make. I've been thinking, like, you know, we could like force every Congress people to actually place a bond, like a $1 million bond that they would lose if they fail in their promises, something like this.
Yes, sir.
I, you know, as it relates to, like, take this back to progress happen. So I was during the course, like, I came with like three, political incentives you bring back: transparency and accountability in government, banning and threatening in China. And so going transparency and accountability, talking about the budget gimmicks and having actual accounting. So I was wondering, one, if you go back into those and detail some of them, because I think once you got a clearer picture on that, something that someone in Congress should actually take, and on the through the vessel of transparency and accountability, actually get something done within the budget picture clearer. And going off of that, you can use Fannie and Freddie as an incentive to do that, because that's a favorite whipping boy. And then also China, the way we could eventually be controlled in part by them, but mainly some of the more, what are the budget gimmicks, and, you know, what are they and how do they work? So just want to know more about those.
And let me interrupt before you answer. Let me poll the panel and see if there wouldn't be a willingness, in addition to being here today, each of you would be available to talk to members and staff, wouldn't you, about these issues?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, we could, I mean, if you want, we could, I mean, I'm happy to come and see you and talk, you know, to your boss about all the different budget gimmicks. They're just like a gigantic amount. I mean, you can actually just like, you know, like the rosy assumptions. I mean, everyone does it, right? They all, you know, and it doesn't matter that, for instance, CBO's, growth in GDP is just completely different. OMB is going to be using something else because it helped them kind of like try to present. I mean, the states, they have supposedly balanced budget amendments, and yet, you know, they get away because of budget gimmicks, less so than the federal government. Picking the scoring, you know, choosing, like shopping for scores, like join a committee on taxation or OMB or CBO, or, I mean, you have all this menu that you can pick from and not even be consistent and use one for this and the other one for that. As I said, like, for instance, like, you know, American Express or Capital One, for instance, when you buy stuff with your card, they give you points, right? Well, on their balance sheet, they have to actually write down these points that they're going to have to pay in the future, where the federal government doesn't do this. I mean, this is like, you know, it's we have right now a kind of Enron type, you know, budget or accounting system, which, you know, we would not tolerate it from the private sector, and yet we accept it from the federal government. And I think it is a serious problem. And there's just like a laundry list of all these problems. There are timing gimmicks, number gimmicks. And so we can talk in details about them if you'd like.
Your advice on this, just that if you gave a member of Congress an electoral incentive, like, oh, he's actually taking steps towards reducing the deficit, and they are baby steps because you actually went, you know, change the numbers, but, you know, by getting the actual picture of how much debt is clearer. So basically, I was just like, really good on all this, but I don't see. What would you say, like, the debt that people hear right now is X, like, if you actually solved all the gimmicks and made it a fair picture, would it be like, you know, X plus 5? Or?
Well, I mean, there are different ways to go about this, but I think it's kind of important to educate also people about, you know, the fact that it's the federal government doesn't have money of its own. I think people need to understand that in order for the government to be able to spend money, it needs to tax it, borrow it, or print it, or a mix of all these three, and they have consequences, the consequences that the three of us have been talking about. And I think that this is actually kind of the route to go, is to try to, I mean, like, the problem is, like, budget process reform. It's very exciting for geeks, you know, but, I mean, most people are just, like, just think it's extremely, extremely boring, and yet, you know, I mean, there's a moment where we're going to have to do it, and maybe a way to actually kind of like, you know, make it more relevant that we need this is to actually try to explain to people that government doesn't have money, it needs to take it, you know, it's, it's a double bookkeeping rather than a, and I think like the federal government is very opaque about that reality. I mean, I don't know what your...
You know, I mean, one thing that our organization does, and any of you are welcome to sign up for our budget updates at crfb.org, but we regularly will send out sort of, this is a budget gimmick that we think is going on, or sort of look for these gimmicks in the next budget. A couple things that have happened recently that I've thought are egregious, timing gimmicks in general tend to be. So a lot of times we'll offset something by pushing the costs into the future, pushing more of the hard stuff in the future. In the healthcare bill, they had the CLASS Act offset. I don't know if you know what that was, but it was creating new long-term insurance where you would collect premiums up front, and then they would be paid out over a longer period of time once people were vested, but you used those premiums to offset some of the healthcare bill. That is a gimmick. That is a blatant gimmick that leaves the new program completely unsound. Another thing that we pointed out was that in the new PAYGO, huge pieces of the budget are exempt. And so if you believe in the principle of you need to offset the cost of new things from the perspective of the debt that's accumulating, saying except for AMT, SGR, extending tax cuts, because we don't want to pay for those, that's still going to the debt. So we were concerned about exempting that. And then a third thing to keep an eye on is just such a complicated concept in itself, but budget baselines. So as we do this Budget Process Reform Commission, I think we're trying to think about whether the way to reform baselines, great minds have gone there before and not come up with the perfect solution. But one thing is that that makes a spending increase sound like a cut if you're cutting compared to a certain baseline. And another thing is that things get slipped into it. So if you look at this president's budget, there are already a couple items from the stimulus that were supposed to be temporary that the president has said, well, these are past policies, we should make them permanent. And so they've built them into the baseline, that way not having to offset the cost. So they come up, they creep up all the time. We're always looking for them.
Certainly.
It's a bipartisan ailment. There's no question. But you're welcome. We do try our best to send out sort of warnings and alerts as those things are going on.
Yeah, if I could just add one thing to that, which is, so the primary federal budget is predominantly but not entirely done on a cash flow basis, as Veronique was saying. And there is this question about whether if we use better accounting standards, we would have a different read, right, if we use something more like what the private sector does, which is more of an accrual mindset. It turns out that the United States does actually issue once a year financial statements which are prepared using something closer to private sector standards. So the financial statements of the U.S. government, they traditionally come out in December. It's now mid-February, and they haven't come out quite yet. I don't mean to cast aspersions because the U.S. finances were kind of weird in 2009. But something that either came out in the last week or so and I missed it or is coming out soon is accounting of the federal budget from this different perspective, which will capture some of the thing, correct some of the things that you might think of as errors in the way we currently do our budget accounting, which actually the most prominent is one that doesn't get a lot of attention, which is in the private sector, if you hire an employee and you offer them a pension, each year you have to show up as an expense the amount of money you paid them and some estimate of what you think their future pension liability is going to be for you. In our system, we don't do that. Right, so just the cash cost of all you guys is showing up in the budget. Your healthcare costs are showing up in the budget. But to the extent that you got a traditional pension, which judging by the age of the people in this room is not many of you, but to the extent you got a traditional pension, there are costs associated with that that would show up in these financial statements but aren't showing up the way we do budgeting.
And we had that where one year we showed a budget surplus in this country, but if you did it on the accrual basis, which came out in that one time, we were actually running a deficit because we had increased military, was it healthcare, was it TRICARE? It was either healthcare or pensions. And so it was actually showing a deficit in a year that we were recording a surplus, and that was a really interesting difference.
What government agency does the actual accrual accounting? Did they try to keep that like off the radar when they actually released that? It's not highly publicized?
Well, it's a boring enough document that it stays off the radar pretty well by itself.
If you know Jim Cooper, Congressman Cooper does not try to keep it under the radar. He has done. He is out in the street corner passing it out. And there are a couple others who are really interested in it. Coburn has been, yeah.
The hour is starting to get late, and there's one more question right here. And I'd like to make sure that we give this gentleman some attention before we wrap up today.
Implications the wars and financing will have on long-term debt.
I just have one thing to say. It's like, I mean, again, I really think that even if we were to zero in defense, we would still be facing a dramatic situation. So, I mean, like, you know, as, I mean, I know it was like a big element for kicking Bush out of office, but I mean, defense spending is like the biggest share of discretionary spending, but it's not that much. I mean, I'm not saying that we couldn't like dramatically cut it, that we couldn't do dramatic things to it, but it's not so much our problem. I mean, I'm thinking.
I see it slightly differently. I mean, I think the projected growth in defense isn't the same as entitlements.
Yeah.
That's why you need to look at the longer term problems. But I think that defense is a good chunk of the budget, about a sixth of the budget, and there are a lot of savings that could be found there.
Yeah.
The way that we funded wars, obviously, it was an emergency in the first year, or maybe the second year, and then it became something that was much easier to budget for. You're not going to be able to budget it perfectly. One of the concerns about budgeting for the war with the rest of the budget
is that
it would be built in the baseline. And that meant when we ratcheted down the savings, people would come along and say, oh, well, we'll use those for other things. And the Obama administration has done just that.
Yeah.
All through the campaign, many of the offsets that Obama was saying would be from bringing down the cost of the war. And for those of us who are watching this ahead of time, we are thinking, you know, it's okay to pay for it. You probably borrow in the beginning and need to find a way to pay for it, but you certainly don't want, when the costs are ratcheted down, to use that to pay for some new program, and that's one of the risks now. I do think that budgeting outside when you know those costs are coming doesn't make sense, but I also think not building into the baseline is a helpful thing. That goes back to this geekier baseline concept.
One last housekeeping detail for those of you who are attorneys, staff, counsel, so forth. The Mercatus Center will be having a continuing legal education course on March 2nd. Over on the Senate side, we will be in the Russell Building, 328A. It's the Senate Agriculture Committee Room. And we're going to be looking at the interplay of federal and state law there, the role of state attorney generals in enforcement of federal law, and we certainly invite you and encourage you to come join us for a light breakfast and some CLE credits. That concludes our program today. Please join me in thanking the panel. And thank you for